From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, Iraq unraveling further by the day. The militant Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, capturing three more towns yesterday in western Iraq, taking major border posts with Jordan and Syria. Iraq's neighbors and beyond are deeply invested in what emerges from the country's explosion. They may work with the U.S. They may work against it. John Kerry is working the region right now. This hour On Point, the many irons in Iraq's fire. We'll talk to the neighbors, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Iran. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Will regional players help hold Iraq together or tear it apart? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll go to Egypt, where there is outrage after three Al Jazeera journalists, an Australian, a Canadian, and an Egyptian, have been sentenced to 7 years or more in prison for their reporting. But first, to Iraq and its region. John Kerry in Baghdad this morning, zooming into the green zone, zooming out. Before he got there, he was in Cairo and Amman. Here he was yesterday in Cairo, met with the Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, and talked about the need for a regional solution to end the bloodshed by ISIS in Iraq.
It's ideology of violence and repression is a threat not only to Iraq, but to the entire region. This is a critical moment where together we must urge Iraq's leaders to rise above sectarian motivations and form a government that is united in its determination to meet the needs and speak to the demands of all of their people.
John Kerry in Cairo yesterday. We will go in this hour to Turkey, Iraq's immediate neighbor to the north, to Saudi Arabia, to the south, to Iran, key player to the east, a fellow Shia there. Joining me first from Washington is Shadi Hamid, fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, long based in Doha in the Gulf. He's author of Temptations of Power, Islamists and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East. Shadi Hamid, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Is anybody prepared or capable of really stepping in and putting Iraq back together in the region, helping put it back together, Shadi?
Well, I think in some ways it's probably too late. It's unlikely that the extremists of ISIS are going to get to Baghdad and beat the Shia forces there, but they do hold a considerable amount of territory in other parts of Iraq, and there's little sign that the Iraqi army is going to be able to retake that territory. ISIS has more morale, more unity. It's allied with several other Sunni militant groups, and the momentum is with them right now. So, what you're seeing now is a very reactive response to the crisis in Iraq. Now everyone's talking about Iraq, but did anyone talk about it a month or 2 months ago? And I think in that sense, the U.S. was really caught off guard and hadn't been planning for these kinds of contingencies. And it's not as if ISIS just emerged 2 weeks ago. ISIS has been gaining ground over the past year. And this was really the warning that what happens in Syria doesn't stay in Syria, because this isn't just about Iraq. ISIS was able to rise to prominence and gain control of territory in Syria, and that gave them the momentum to push outside the borders of Syria and continue their rise. And that's what we're seeing right now.
Lots of talk about that. Last week in Geneva, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon saying the violence in Iraq poses a serious risk to its neighbors.
There is a real risk of further sectarian violence on a massive scale within Iraq and beyond its borders.
And Iraq's foreign minister, Hossein Zebari, talking with the BBC today, saying you've got fighters coming in from all over the world. This violence can spill back out.
All these volunteers from Britain, from European countries who are fighting in the suburbs of Mosul or Tikrit or Fallujah, they will be going back to their countries. And so it is an Iraqi fight. This is our fight. We have to win it. But believe me, it has regional and international dimensions.
Shadi Hamid in Washington, what are the implications for, just let's start with the immediate neighbors, if Iraq ends up split up here with something maybe claiming to be an Islamic caliphate in its north and west, What are the implications? Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Iran?
Well, sure. I mean, look, it's worth really understanding the gravity of what's happening here, that here you have an extremist group that controls large swaths of territory in Syria and Iraq. And in that sense, you have a base of extremism and potentially terrorism down the road. And the ambitions of ISIS are not limited to nation states in the normal sense. They have broader regional ambitions, and they're not gonna stop at borders. And they question the whole concept, the whole notion of the Middle East as divided nation states, and they want to move towards a caliphate and blur the borders. Now, it's unrealistic they're actually going to accomplish their goal, but they have already accomplished the goal of blurring the borders and changing the way we talk about the Middle East. I mean, right now, Iraq is not a nation state as we would understand the phrase. Iraq is divided into different territory ruled by different factions, whether it's the Kurds, the Shia Muslims, and now Sunni militants in various parts of the country. So in that sense, it changes the map, and it emboldens other militant groups across the region to follow in suit. And that could be in Libya. It could be in parts of the Sahel and Tunisia in North Africa. Yemen, certainly, we've seen a considerable al-Qaeda presence in over the past few years. So in this sense, I mean, what we're really seeing is the kind of it's a moment for jihadis. This is the Salafi jihadi moment in the Middle East, where the more mainstream moderate Islamist groups like the Muslim Brotherhood are entering some kind of decline. They're falling by the wayside. And groups like the Brotherhood were telling their followers an Islamic state or an Islamic society is possible through gradualism, through the democratic process and working within the system. Mm. These new these extremist groups like ISIS, they have no time for gradualism. They tell their followers, we will create the Islamic state now through brute force. And violence has worked in that respect.
It is hard to keep up with the scope of implications here, but we're working on that today, looking at the region. Shadi, stand by in Washington. Let's go to Iraq's northern neighbor, Turkey. Soli Ozel joins us from Istanbul, professor of international relations at Kadir Has University, foreign news editor, columnist at the Gazette Habertürk, a big daily newspaper in Turkey. Soli Ozel, thank you very much for being with us.
You're most welcome.
Turkey was the last caliphate in this area. Do you think it's real? Looking at what's happened with ISIS, could you see a new caliphate emerging on your southern border?
No, I personally don't. I'm sure there are people who wish it, but I really don't think that is likely to happen.
Do you think we are seeing...
Remember that when the caliphate was abolished in 1924, when the new Turkish Republic was after the Turkish Republic was founded, there were efforts to reestablish or reinstitute the caliphate, and those efforts did not succeed. I really don't see any reason as to why they could succeed now.
Do you see the destruction of Iraq as we have known it for half a century and more?
I think Shadi Hamid already said it. Iraq as we know it, just like Syria as we know, we've known them, I don't think any longer exists. The borders may remain in place formally, but I think as political realities, those entities no longer exist. How long their self-destruction and their destruction are going to continue is difficult to say. But again, those are no longer the entities that we've known for the last 90 years.
What are the implications for Turkey? Will Turkey establish relations with a Sunni state in what has been northwestern Iraq?
Well, Turkey will continue to have relations with Baghdad like the rest of the world. As I said, formally borders may not change, and formally everybody may pretend that Baghdad and Damascus still control the entire territory, which will not be the case. The single most important difference for Turkey is going to be, and that already the Turkish foreign policy has moved in that direction, is basically to make the relations with the Iraqi Kurdistan, the Kurdistan regional government, even cozier. And I'm not quite certain, by the way, that the ISIS project is going to be durable. I may be proven wrong. So maybe Turkey will never have to be a neighbor to a radical Sunni Islamist entity, not necessarily a state, to the south. That will remain to be seen. I think right now, almost all the countries, I mean, every country in the world that is a state has an interest in making sure that ISIS does not establish itself as a as the political authority in that stretch of the Syrian and Iraqi land that they now control.
But they are certainly making progress steadily over the last week and a half. Do you think the government in Baghdad has the capacity, from your perch there in Istanbul, do you think they have the capacity to reunite the country and reestablish central control?
No. But, I mean, for the moment, what they're interested in is to make sure that Baghdad does not fall, and I don't think it will. ISIS is smart enough not to actually touch Shia-dominant areas either. And so the game is going to be played where the Sunnis live, and the key is going to be whether or not all the forces around Iraq and the United States will together be able to convince other forces that help ISIS succeed this much, whether it be Baathi forces or tribal forces who have been thoroughly alienated from central authority because of sectarian policies of Prime Minister Maliki, who, by the way, had been supported by the United States almost unconditionally. Well, if they can be separated from ISIS, then I think ISIS success story may not go on forever.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about regional reaction to and interests in the meltdown in Iraq, how Turkey, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and more look at what's going on right now, the profound evolution of, you name it, just about everything in Iraq right now. Shadi Hamid joins us from the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution in Washington today, author of Temptations of Power. From Istanbul, Turkey right now, we're joined by Soli Ozel, foreign news editor, columnist at the Gazette Habertürk, big daily newspaper in Turkey. And I wonder about this emergence of Kurdistan. The Kurds seem to be profiting in some way from what's going on here, establishing control over Kirkuk, becoming maybe the only firm piece of this map of Iraq. Is that welcomed by Turkey? A problem for Turkey? What is it, Mr. Ozel?
Well, if you asked me this question 6 years ago, the answer would have been certainly the Turkish state would be very unhappy about these developments. But since then, actually, since the war in Iraq in 2003, things have changed dramatically. Iraqi Kurdistan has become one of Turkey's main trade partners. The two sides are cooperating, and in fact, whereas it used to be that the Turks would say that the Americans wanted to divide Iraq up, now the Americans are saying to the Turks that, by the way, the Turks treat the Kurdistan regional government, they are actually undermining Baghdad's authority and de facto dividing, partitioning Iraq. So in that sense, if 5 years ago Kirkuk was invaded by the Kurds, the country here in Turkey would go up in arms, but now it's been basically received rather quietly. A lot of people are still very concerned, but I don't think the formal independence of Iraqi Kurdistan is going to come anytime soon, although de facto they are almost semi-independent. And Turkey will continue to have good relations with those because, as I said, business interests are well entrenched. And furthermore, it's the only stable, as you said, it's the only stable part of Iraq, and beyond their borders is basically hell. And it's not bad to have a cushion between you and hell.
Hell beyond the border and Turkey welcoming a cushion. What about Shadi Hamid's observation that this is the Salafi jihad moment? What can Turkey do, if anything, to help push back or tamp down ISIS and its gains in north and northwestern Iraq?
Well, it is very difficult to fight with these organizations, and yes, it may very well be their moment, and there are, I'm sure, plenty of sympathizers, in fact, probably plenty of fighters from Turkey among the ISIS fighters, as there are among Nusra fighters and what have you. I think, as I said earlier, it will require a regional policy when all states who are threatened by the existence of such a potent transnational actor that can establish its own state, that it will take all these states to work together to neutralize, then to neuter, and then to eliminate to the extent possible this type of organization. It will have to be a really long term. It will have to be a really long term project. In the meantime, Turkey will have to make sure that its borders are secure, and that its intelligence operations along the territory that ISIS controls is actually pretty strong, and make sure that domestically it does not have to suffer the consequences of the collective fight against ISIS.
We're going to go on around Iraq's borders.
Which, by the way, holds about 49 diplomats and personnel of the Turkish consulate in Mosul, and about 31 Turkish drivers. So that makes Turkey's position more delicate than perhaps others.
There's leverage and threat right there. Shadi Hamid, how do you see Turkey in this? We'll go on around the borders, but do you see Turkey as threatened by the ISIS lightning advance and takeover of so much of Iraq, Shadi?
I mean, obviously it's problematic for Turkey as it is for all the countries in the region, but as Soli said, the Turks are in a good position with the Kurds in particular, and that's been one of the successes, I think, of Turkish foreign policy, where there were major issues both domestically and with their neighbors in terms of the relationships with Kurdish populations. They were able to really build a strong, vibrant relationship, and that, I think, puts them in good stead going forward as the Kurds become a more prominent player on the regional scene and as they establish kind of de facto independence. But I think now Turkey is awakened to the threat, and I think there were some concerns that the Turks were turning a blind eye or not doing enough to counter extremism in Syria in particular. They were so focused on the Assad regime to the exclusion of other threats, but I think now it's become a very stark issue for them precisely because of the capture of Turkish diplomats in Mosul. So in that sense, ISIS has really made and a real enemy of the Turks. And this is the thing, we're going to see over the coming weeks and months that a regional coalition developing to fight ISIS. Now, whether they'll be successful or not is a different issue. The U.S. is the main player here. The U.S. has the firepower to really effectively push back ISIS, but there are serious questions about whether the world and the region can count on U.S. commitments here. And as we know, Obama sees Iraq and the broader Middle East, I think, more as a nuisance than anything else.
Soli Ozel, just another minute with you. We don't know what the U.S. will do beyond the 300 or so President Obama has promised. Does Turkey want to see the United States militarily engaged in Iraq again or not?
No, certainly not under conditions where 80 of its citizens are actually being held hostage. To the best of our knowledge, the way the Turkish media reported it, when Turkish Prime Minister spoke with Vice President Biden, that was one of the requests that the United States not bomb ISIS forces. But that's what the Iraqi government, as far as I understand, is what it wants. To the extent that I can follow American politics, I don't think the United States is terribly interested in getting involved fully again, and the president said no boots on the ground. I guess the first step would have to come from within Iraq, that is, whether or not Maliki will resign and another government that could actually bring together disparate forces within Iraqi society are going to be able to form the government. I think the political process will get precedence. If that doesn't work, then we may see the military option becoming stronger.
Soli Ozel at Kadir Has University and Gazette Habertürk in Istanbul, Turkey. Thank you so much for joining us, Soli.
Thank you for having me.
Let's go to Saudi Arabia, immediately to Iraq's south. In Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, Siraj Wahab joins us now, senior editor at Arab News, leading English language news source in Saudi Arabia. Siraj Wahab, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
Is ISIS a creation of Saudi Arabian money?
Absolutely not. And this is ridiculous, as has been explained by our foreign minister, Prince Saud al-Faisal, because Saudi Arabia has always taken a stand against extremist elements, and Saudi Arabia has fought a long war with these extremists who come from the Al-Qaeda. They are cut from the same cloth. And ISIS, Saudi Arabia sees as a terror group. It has been explained publicly and to everyone. that ISIS is not a savior of Iraq, but it is a destroyer of Iraq. There are no ifs, no buts about this terror group, that it is a threat to the entire region. So Saudi Arabia, there is no way, and it is laughable to really suggest that Saudi Arabia can be behind this extremist organization. It is certainly, definitely not.
But, you know, it comes up again and again. Sometimes people say, well, maybe not the government, but wealthy individuals within Saudi Arabia. Any truth in that?
Absolutely not. The kind of, the checks and balances that are there because of money laundering thing. You know, 9/11 taught so many lessons to Saudi Arabia as to, you know, where the money flows from, where it goes from, how does it land into the hands of extremists. So all the loopholes have been plugged, and there is absolutely no way. Even the wealthy individuals would not go against the government line because they know exactly that these people are a threat to the region. They are beyond it. They are loose cannons. They are under nobody's control. And this is the reason why Saudi Arabia has always been impressing upon the international community to intervene in Syria and to intervene because, you know, these people, these extremists, thrive whenever there is a political vacuum. Unless and until you run the swamp dry, these people will come up again and again because all these issues need to be dealt with politically. When in the absence of political dialogue, in the absence of inclusive politics, these people will find a way to thrive in which, and we have seen ISIS thriving in such a scenario.
Siraj Wahab in Jeddah, what are the implications for Saudi Arabia of a sectarian crack-up in Iraq that may leave some kind of Sunni state in the north and west and on your border, even a caliphate? What are the implications of a Sunni entity outside Baghdad's control rising in Iraq?
No, the implications are very dire. The thing is, you know, these people, because Saudi Arabia has fought a long and hard battle against them, the entire GCC state is now cooperating with each other to stop this menace. But the thing is, what Saudi Arabia has been telling the international community is, because al-Maliki has played sectarian politics in Iraq, and he has excluded all these Sunni tribal chiefs, these are the people who General Petraeus brought them into the political mainstream. He made them, the Sunni tribal chiefs, fight al-Qaeda, defeat al-Qaeda, and they became part of the political process. And when they became part of the political process, the militia force of Muqtada Sadr and Nouri al-Maliki, they tried to exclude them from sharing power with this Sunni bloc, as a result of which they have lost faith in the political process. Now, when ISIS started conquering swathes of land in Iraq, you saw willing population embracing the terrorists because they have been under the terror of Maliki government. So much so that such is the dichotomy that they feel better under the ISIS than under Maliki. You can imagine the terror unleashed by the Maliki government.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. Siraj Wahab, please stand by in Jeddah. Shadi Hamid is with us in Washington. Siraj, our callers are coming in, and I want to begin to allow them to join. Bill in Boston calling. Hi, Bill, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. I just have one overarching question. How is it that the CIA and the NSA did not see this coming? I mean, it's astonishing to me that, you know, if they care to, they probably know that I'm talking to your program right now, but 2 weeks ago they didn't know there were thousands and thousands of ISIS troops massing on the western borders of Iraq, the northern borders of Iraq.
Yeah, well, of course, it's a great question. I mean, bear in mind, there were people already in Iraq who quickly joined them. But nevertheless, let me take that to Jeddah in Saudi Arabia and Siraj Wahab. What about it, Siraj? We read in the reporting that Secretary of State John Kerry, in his conference call with regional leaders, was greeted with bewilderment by regional leaders that the U.S. did not see this coming. How could this have happened without intelligence awareness, Siraj?
This is very surprising that, you know, that the CIA or the Americans did not see it coming. Saudi Arabia has been saying it again and again and repeatedly that there is a need for international intervention in Syria because the vacuum that was being created there, the moderate elements, the moderate opposition there who were taking on the Assad regime, they were left to fend for themselves, as a result of which the extremist elements got strengthened, and it was being repeatedly pointed out to the Americans that, look, al-Maliki's sectarian policy and his implementation of the Iranian agenda in Iraq is alienating the Sunnis in Iraq. And unless until ever since Tariq Hashmi was hounded out of Iraq, now this is a towering Sunni leader, he was hounded out of Iraq by the same al-Maliki government. And Saudi Arabia was telling the world again and again that look, what is happening in Iraq is not good for democracy, is not good for what is happening there. And as a result of which, the vacuum that was created, and you had these peaceful demonstrators in Ramada and Fallujah, and you have al-Maliki government steamrolling them and running tanks over them, and this had to happen, and I wonder how, and we in the region wonder how the Americans have been taken by surprise by all this. Whenever there is a vacuum anywhere, look, exactly this is what has happened in Afghanistan. When Taliban came to power, the warlord had run amok. They had terrorized the population, as a result of which the population thought the Taliban are their savior, and they ran up to them, they embraced them. This is exactly what is happening in Iraq. They are running into the embrace of the terrorists, thinking that they are their saviors.
Are we at risk of a Sunni-Shia regional war here, Siraj Wahab?
Absolutely, there is no doubt, unless and until there is an intervention, unless and until there is a unity government, there is still many saner elements in Iraq who understand the implications of what is happening there now. There are a lot of good many people there. The only problem is the al-Maliki government sectarian agenda.
But an intervention by whom, sir? The United States was there for almost a decade. An intervention by whom?
The intervention by the local regional people, the neighboring countries who can bring all the factions together and to have a unity government there minus al-Maliki and to stop this interference from Iran. This is a big problem. The Iranian proxies in the form of al-Qaeda, Muqtada Sadr, you saw the parade that they did yesterday, 2 days ago, in the streets of Baghdad. There is this militia, Shiite militia and all that.
But they were oppressed for many years by a Sunni minority, so you can understand their sensitivity.
But these are the people who fought the Americans in the street of Baghdad when Americans came to liberate them.
Mohammed in Omaha, Nebraska. Mohammed, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I would just like to make a point. I mean, I respect the gentleman's opinion. I'm a human rights activist from Syria. You know, the United States and Saudi Arabia and Israel always been behind filling the holes. Between ISIS on the Turkish border, Saudi Arabia have a hospital for ISIS. Heavy weapons come through, trained by the CIA. Everyone got on the battlefield. So you're talking about the spreading. ISIS is supported by the United States 100% in Saudi Arabia. So you have it's a proxy war to destroy Syria and Iraq to get Iran. It's all, you know, planned before ahead of time. And what they did in the Gulf War has created a disaster, which is a race between Shia and Sunni. And that's what the whole problem.
Mohammed, our time is short. Siraj, please stand by. And Shadi Hamid, the United States and Saudi Arabia as supporters of ISIS to spark a sectarian war to get at Iran?
I mean, there's absolutely no evidence that the U.S. has supported ISIS fighters. And just the very thought of that is hard to take seriously. But yes, I mean, the U.S. has supported moderate Syrian rebels and tried to arm some, but we have to make clear distinctions between rebel groups. Where I do think the U.S. deserves blame is not just on the intelligence failure, but this entire administration has not prioritized a proactive agenda for the region. They wait until the fire to happen, and then they try to put out the fire, but by then it can be too late.
Shadi Hamid in Washington, please stand by. Siraj Wahab at the Arab News in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. We're grateful to you for joining us for a few minutes today. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a regional reaction to and interests in the meltdown underway right now in Iraq. How Turkey, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and more look at what is going on inside Iraq from their very, very close berths there right next door. And we will go to Egypt before this hour is over, where three Al Jazeera journalists have been sentenced to 7 years, 10 years in prison on charges that seem, well, there's a lot of outrage there and beyond today over those convictions in Egyptian court. Shadi Hamid joins us from the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. We'll go to Iran in just a moment. Last week, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani spoke to a crowd at a stadium near the border of Iraq in Karamabad, Iran, said that under certain circumstances, he would be ready to intervene in the Iraq crisis. Here's Rouhani interpreted by Iranian state-owned Press TV.
To all superpowers, their mercenaries, assassins, and terrorists, we declare that the great Iranian nation will spare no efforts to protect the dignity of Iraq's holy shrines.
Iraq's holy shrines. They would protect their dignity. Of course, those are Shia holy shrines, sacred to many in Iran as well. Let's go to Tehran in Iran and Mohammad Marandi. He's an Iranian political scientist, professor at the University of Tehran's Institute for North American and European Studies. Mohammad Marandi, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let me ask, do you think, in retrospect, that Iran has overplayed its hand in backing a strong Shia central government to the point that it may have helped create a backlash here in the unraveling of Iraq that we see right now?
No, I don't think that that is an accurate assessment of the situation. The Iranians supported the legitimate government in Iraq that won its position through elections and through building a coalition. Whether the Iranians agree with everything that the administration in Iraq does or has been doing over the past few years is one thing. But recognizing the legitimate government and supporting it is something else. The Iranians have not interfered in the sense that it has not forced anyone to leave government, or Iran has never dictated to political parties in Iraq who should be in and who should be out. But they did try to help facilitate them coming together in the past. I think the real problem, though, is unfortunately, and I know this will be controversial among many of your listeners in the United States, and that is a very unholy alliance between the United States and Saudi Arabia that began in the late 1970s over Afghanistan, where the United States allowed the Saudis basically to start establishing madrasas and funding extremists. The United States too funded some of these extremist organizations, which later turned out to be Al-Qaeda. And also later on, the Taliban was allowed to rise in Afghanistan with the help of the Pakistani ISI and the Saudi government. That, of course, led to the tragedy on September 11th. Unfortunately, history is again repeating itself. The Americans allowed their client regimes in this region to fund extremists in Syria of different sorts, Jihad al-Nusra, the Islamic Front, and Daesh, or ISIL, along with many other groups. And these groups have now become much stronger than anything we've ever seen in Afghanistan. And because the structure of Iraq has been utterly destroyed by the American invasion, the spillover into Iraq has created this situation. So the extremists coming into Iraq are from Syria, and the whole policy of the United States by aligning itself to the Saudis and other oil-rich Arab dictatorships has led to this. And we see it in Libya, we see it in Egypt, we've seen it in Mali. This is not something just in this part of the world, it's also in Africa. Boko Haram in Nigeria is linked to the extremist ideology that comes from Saudi Arabia, just like the Taliban. And today we've seen another explosion in Nigeria.
Mohammad Marani, let me ask you, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said there Iran might get involved if the Shia shrines in Iraq were threatened. Let's say they're not, but a Sunni, hardline militant ISIS state of some kind is being established in north and western Iraq. Will Iran accept that?
Well, you know, I think an accurate translation of the text would reveal that he never spoke of sending troops into Iraq. There are no troops, Iranian troops.
I understand that. He said would spare no effort. So, fair enough. But
yes,
he drew a kind of line there.
Yes, if you'd listen to the previous sentences and the sentences afterwards, he was speaking about supporting the Iraqi people and the Iraqi population. And
fair enough, then. But please take the question on its own merits.
Sure.
Will Iran accept some kind of new Sunni state within what were the boundaries of Iraq? Mohammed Morandi, are you there, sir? That question may be lost in the ether, maybe too tough. Shadi Hamid, do I have you?
Yes, I'm here, yep.
I think I may have lost Mohammed. I don't know if the question was too tough or we just lost the line, but what about it? If Baghdad can't retake this territory and some kind of Sunni entity develops there, will Iran stand by?
Iran sees this as an existential threat, and they have real skin in the game. Where the U.S. were a little bit unsure about how involved they want to be, Iran, this is, you know, right on its border, and they see the rise of Sunni militancy and extremism as one of the primary security concerns. That said, I mean, I might disagree with my Iranian colleague on Iran's role in all of this, because Iran has been supporting one of the most sectarian regimes in the region, and that's the Syrian regime. And one of the reasons ISIS was able to rise in Syria was because of the civil war there. So we can't just leave Syria out of this. And I think there's a lot of blame to go around, including with Saudi Arabia. But Iran bears a lot of responsibility for fomenting sectarianism through its support of the Assad regime. And, I mean, there are Iranian military forces on the ground in Syria backing Assad and exacerbating a situation where the Syrian regime has been killing civilians and continues to be quite brutal. So it's just important not to forget about that.
Absolutely. Mohammed Morandi, I think we have you back in Tehran. Two questions, and I know we have to let you go.
Can I respond to what has just been said?
Yes.
First of all, I disagree. There are no Iranian boots on the ground in Syria, and there never have been. There have been Iranian advisors, but no.
Oh, that line is just getting really rough, and I'm sorry about that, because there's more we'd like to know. Shadi, with that heavy investment, two questions. I'll put the questions to you then. Do you think Iran would accept some kind of Sunni entity within Iraq's borders, former borders, if they're dissolving? And B, will they help pressure Nouri al-Maliki to leave office so that some kind of unity government creating some chance of restoration of Iraq might engage?
Yes, there's no way they're going to accept any long-term ISIS presence.
What are they going to do about it? Everybody says the Iraqi army itself can't kick it out, and Mohammed says they're not going to come in with their own Iranian boots on the ground.
Yeah, I think what they'll try to do is to provide military advisors to the Maliki government. They may try to broker some kind of agreement between different Shia parties. I don't think they're going to throw Maliki under the bus necessarily, but there is a lot of jockeying now for power and influence in Iraq's government, and there are challengers to Maliki. So maybe at some point the different parties will have to sit together and work out a resolution where Maliki brings others into the government, or perhaps through forming new coalitions, they're able to push Maliki out. I mean, but that will take that could take months. So in terms of a short-term solution, the Iraqi political process can be very slow, and there's a lot of give and take from different parties. But I think Iran will be very central in helping facilitate any negotiations. They have good relationships with all the major Shia parties.
We're going to turn in just a moment to Egypt, and I'm afraid we've lost Mohammed Morandi there in Tehran at the Tehran's Institute for North American and European Studies. Overall, Shadi, when you look, the U.S. says, the president here says, we'll send in maybe 300 advisors. John Kerry there today, in and out of the green zone in Baghdad. If the U.S. is going to have a light footprint here, do you see the region, the neighbors, helping sort of cauterize this wound and pull things back together, or acting as a wedge that will drive things further apart, even go to a wider sectarian conflict?
Well, this is the same old story of the past 3 years. With the U.S. disengaging from the Middle East, there's a real power and security vacuum in the region. And a lot of different factions and proxy groups have tried to fill in the gap, and it's become increasingly messy as a result. I think a lot of regional powers are looking to the U.S. for leadership to provide a strategic vision for addressing not just Iraq, but also Syria, because these issues, of course, are intertwined. But they're not seeing that. They're seeing a lot of shuttle diplomacy from Kerry, but to what end? What is the bigger strategic framework here? And no one, everyone can sense, and having lived in the Gulf for 4 years in Qatar, this was always one of the perceptions that I saw, that Obama is disinterested. He doesn't want to get more involved. He sees his legacy as extracting the U.S. from the Middle East. But I think now Obama's legacy, as we look back, will be presiding over the breakup or the further destruction and deterioration of the Middle East. And the U.S. could have done more and didn't.
We're going to turn to Egypt. I'm sorry we lost Mohamed Mirandi there in Tehran, but I appreciate him joining us today. And Shadi Hamid, please stand with us. News in Egypt just after John Kerry leaving there today. Three journalists for Al Jazeera sentenced to 7 to 10 years in jail. The charge was aiding terrorists and endangering national security because they were reporting on the Muslim Brotherhood. The verdict has been called a dark day for media freedom by Al Jazeera, and a sentiment shared very widely. Joining us now from Cairo is Louisa Lovelock, Egypt correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She's been covering Egypt for several years. Louisa Lovelock, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
We have heard repeatedly from reporters who attended the trial that there was no evidence brought to bear before these convictions. Does that square with your understanding of what just happened?
It certainly indicates that there was no evidence brought to bear that convinced either any human rights groups or any independent lawyers who were in the court. We did see reams and reams of video evidence, often interviews with the Muslim Brotherhood, and also some more bizarre things like videos of a trotting horse, for example. But that, certainly in the minds of the lawyers I've spoken to, did not amount to anything that could convict these people.
There's been international uproar since they were first held in December. All over the world, people saying, you know, free these journalists. Why do you think the court has gone ahead, Egypt has gone ahead with this conviction?
Well, there are two key issues here. The first is that Egypt's judiciary is independent. We often talk about it as an institution which makes politicized verdicts and perhaps gets phone calls from above. But what's very clear is that the judiciary is sort of signing and sealing the crackdown. It's doing the exact things that the regime might want, but it's not necessarily taking direct orders. So that's point number one. Point number two is that since the coup last year, Egypt has undergone a period of fierce nationalist resurgence, and they've made it very clear time and time again that they will not accept interference in their internal affairs. And certainly that's what this campaign, this international campaign, is being viewed as.
As interference, but we had John Kerry in Cairo just yesterday talking about human rights and the judicial process there, reevaluating that. Is this a slap in the face to the American government?
It certainly looks that way. The American government did actually resume part of their aid package 10 days ago, and that was announced yesterday. But what's very clear at the moment is that although we might talk as if America has a great deal of influence in Egypt, that's actually not the case these days, if indeed it ever was.
Shadi Hamid in Washington, what do you make of this conviction? The whole world watching here, no one's saying there's persuasive evidence of any kind brought here, and yet very heavy sentences delivered. Does Egypt feel beyond international reproach?
Yes, I mean, Egypt has become one of the most repressive regimes in the region, which is saying quite a lot, just in terms of the sheer numbers arrested and killed since the military coup last July. And I think that's become clear to all international observers by now. But the international community does have considerable leverage. I mean, the U.S. does provide $1.3 billion of military assistance every year, and there's no substitute for that. So if the U.S. was really serious, it could fully suspend that aid.
Yesterday, John Kerry expressed confidence that Washington would quickly resume that aid.
This is precisely the problem. The U.S. is totally unwilling to put serious pressure, and to have John Kerry, and he's been saying this for the last few months, that he's hoping to restore assistance to Egypt as soon as possible. What message does that send to a regime that is engaging in repressive practices? I mean, the bottom line is that the Egyptian army can't run its tanks and F-16s without U.S. spare parts and maintenance. Russia, China, no one can provide a substitute on that front. So the question is not so much whether the U.S. has leverage, but whether it's willing to use its leverage to pressure the Egyptian regime. At least we're not even talking about pushing Egypt to become a democracy. That is not going to happen, but to at least be less repressive.
And here, a clear outrage against free press reporting right in the center of that. Louisa Lovelock, what's the precedent here? 7 years for two of these, a Canadian national, an Australian national, 10 years for another. Is there an appeal process? Could this be reversed? What's the expectation in Cairo?
Well, the first step for the families does seem to be an appeals process, of which there is one that can go through various stages. One possibility that still remains open is that President Sisi could actually pardon the journalists. If he were to do this, however, he would probably take a few weeks, if not months, to do this, as he's keen to show that he is a leader for Egyptians and not for anyone else. And so he would certainly want to show that he was not allowing the international community to interfere here.
Open repression of press freedoms in Egypt as we speak, as of now. Louisa Lovelock, Egypt correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Thank you for joining us from Cairo, Louisa. And Shadi Hamid in Washington at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Shadi, thanks for looking around the region with us today. Very grateful for your time and insights.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, thank you for joining us here. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR, on Twitter. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.